Are you ready, Becky?
Yes, we are. Before you begin, would you like please recognize today's Becky's birthday?
Before we're on the record, this is very important here. It's Becky's birthday, everybody. And 47 and counting is what we last heard.
No, it's me.
All right, now we'll call the meeting to order. This meeting of the House Hess Committee is called to order February 21st. It is 3:04 p.m. and I'm Con Bundy presiding. Committee members present are Representative Rochberg, Representative Gary Davis, myself, and Representative Cynthia Tuohy. On today's calendar, we have a briefing on impact aid from Dwayne Guiley. We'll discuss House Bill 28, possession of guns on school property, and House Bill 94, private management of public schools. And Mr. Guiley, if you would begin, please, we'll look forward to your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dwayne Guiley, Department of Education, and with me today is staff member Eddie Jeans. Eddie actually does the calculation of the federal disparity and presents the information to the U.S. Office of Impact Aid annually and negotiates any changes in our disparity calculation with that office. So he's here with me to keep me straight on target on the methodology. I provided you with two handouts in the attempt to have a visual. I have one handout that just basically talks about basic need in our formula, and then I have another detailed handout that's the actual calculation of our federal disparity for 1993. Basically, disparity under the federal law is a recognition of difference in either revenue or expense available to support each student at individual school districts within each state. The methodologies and the procedures had been established in regulation prior to October of 94. When the federal law was reauthorized in October of 94, they moved the definition of disparity and the procedural calculations into the federal law. They also changed the disparity limit within the federal law and changed the year of data which should be used to measure disparity. Prior to October of 94, disparity had been 25% maximum. And it had used current year data on which to determine whether or not a state was in compliance. Under the new federal law, the 25% applies to fiscal years 95, 96, and 97. And then it's reduced to 20% in fiscal years 98 and 99. The federal law further provides that the data that a state will use is from two fiscal years prior. So the law took effect in October of 94, which was partway into our fiscal year 95, and then stated that we'll use 93 data to determine whether or not we're in compliance in 95. So we'll be using our 93 data once for fiscal year 93 and once for fiscal year 95. And the question that has brought this to the forefront at the present time is the fact that in 1996, that data will be the first data used for a 20% year, which is 1998. And there is an exception in the federal law that says if a state substantially revises its funding formula and submits that revision to the U.S. Secretary, along with preliminary data or estimated data, that shows the state intends to keep disparity to a maximum 20% limit, and further provides an assurance that if based on audited data after the year ends, the state is not within the 20% disparity limit, the state will in fact refund any amounts deducted from districts that received impact aid. So if the state is willing to provide that application to the U.S. Secretary, then the U.S. Secretary can allow the state an exception from the two-year data rule and allow current year data to be used under the new formula. So there's the possibility then of either maintaining disparity at less than 20% in FY96 or in fact having a new formula in place to be implemented for fiscal year 1998, and therefore we could have disparity go up as high as 25% in 96 and in 97 and not be out of compliance in 98. Now, We do disparity in the state of Alaska slightly different than other states have accomplished disparity, because our method of distributing revenue to school districts is based on an instructional unit. It's not based on a per student standard. And we were successful in the reauthorization of the federal impact aid to have a section put into the law that allowed us to continue to use the instructional unit formula. So we measure our disparity in Alaska based on the instructional unit, the relative value of each instructional unit at each of our 54 districts and Mount Edgecombe. And we're allowed to ignore the 5% of the wealthiest units and the 5% of the poorest units. And we measure our disparity based on the 90% of the units that are left, the 90% in the middle, if you will. And we measure it based on revenue, not expense, because our state law does not control expenditures. Our state law only controls the method of distributing revenue. So, unique to the state of Alaska, then, the actual disparity standard is the difference in revenue available to support each instructional unit at each of the 54 districts and Mount Edgecombe within our state, based upon local, state, and certain federal revenues. And my little chart here shows basically one adjusted instruction unit is worth $61,000. The sources, the potential sources of that $61,000 include state foundation aid, federal impact aid, and in the case of city and borough districts, the required 4-mil local contribution. Those are the three sources that go into the $61,000. Basic need under our state law is simply the total number of units times the area differential unique to that district times the unit value, which the unit value is set in statute at $61,000. Now on page 2, our current statute allows city and borough districts that have resource to tax to contribute an amount in excess of basic need, which is not to exceed 23% of the basic need calculation. Or based on unit value, that's another $14,030 on top of the minimum state aid, the federal impact aid, and that 4-mil minimum local contribution. Some people have come to think of our local cap as 4 mils plus 2 mils equals 6, but they're confusing two issues. The 4 mil constitutes the minimum local contribution. The 23% of basic need accounts for the allowable excess. Also included in our law is for those districts that have extreme tax wealth, if they first reach 35% of basic need before they hit 4 mils, they will contribute 35% as a minimum, and then they're allowed a 2 mil excess. So it's a combination of two ideas that gets people to the 6 mils, but the 6 is not set forth in statute. So 23% is the allowable excess that we're talking about. 23% correlates closely with disparity, but does not mean that's what our disparity is. Over the last several years, our disparity has ranged from about 23.4% down to about 19.25. Throughout the life of this current formula, which came in FY88, the excess local contribution allowed began at 21%, and then it increased to 23%. Based upon pressure to want to contribute more at the local level. So while the local contribution cap has been at 23%, our actual disparity has exceeded 23%. Part of the reason is our local cap does not control, as an example, transfers into the general fund from other funds. It only controls the amount of excess local contributions that can happen. So that other activities that take place at the school district level that are outside of this cap. The final page of the three shows the total value then, including the excess local on a unit basis of $75,030 is what's controlled within our statute. So we simply make a comparison then of the top end unit value with the low end unit value, calculate the difference, and then we calculate disparity. Now, the low end unit value is normally set by our REAA districts, or those districts that do not have access to local taxes. The high-end value traditionally is set by one of our city borough districts that does, in fact, have access to local contributions. The other document that I've prepared for you is a copy of our actual disparity calculation for FY93.
Excuse me, just an interruption. If we could put a name and a face to the top end and the low end. I assume there's only one on the top end.
Well, actually, in 1993, the top end was Ketchikan at $75,025. And the actual low end was the Lower Kuskokwim School District at $62,621.
So nobody actually makes a 61?
No, everyone was above the 61 because of local interest earnings and other revenues outside of basic need.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
Oh. So the two-page handout that's the actual disparity calculation that we present to the federal government along with several pages of backup material shows that we account for the actual foundation payments and any adjustments that come from the audit and other state revenues. We account for each of the local revenues, including in-kind contributions or the valuation of services that are not purchased but are provided by the city or borough to the school district, to come up with a subtotal of local revenue. And then we look at the federal revenues, including the deductible portion of the impact aid and other federal revenues, and then we come up with a total which includes, again, our transfers into the general fund from other funds. So in column R, we have what's called our FY93 audited total revenues. In column S, we have the adjusted units. Now, under the federal law, we are allowed to exclude any costs that are associated with unique geographic factors, with special needs students, and with other things that relate to a unique profile of student. But in the state of Alaska, the way our unit formula works, if we ignore those things, such as our area differential and those special needs students, it actually increases our disparity. It tends to increase our disparity because at the urban districts, they have less unit than that they spread their local dollars across. And remember, we're measuring the relative value of a unit. So if you have a fixed pool of local dollars, as your number of units goes down, the relative value of each unit goes up. Because the state law controls basic need, the local municipality controls the excess local contribution. In the REAs, again, where they have no access to tax, they have access to certain things such as interest earnings, facility rentals, disposal of assets, and potentially transfers in from other funds to increase their unit value above the $61,000. So again, in the specific example here, we're allowed under the federal law to exclude the 5% of the wealthy at the top. We look at the bottom of column S, and we see that in 1993 we had 11,806.51 instructional units. 5% of that number allows us to exclude 590.33 at the top and the bottom. So we rank them in value sequence from the most wealthy unit or the most expensive unit to the poorest unit, and we start subtracting from the top until we hit the number of 590. When we get to the district of Ketchikan, we cannot exclude all of Ketchikan's units because we would exceed the 590. So Ketchikan sets the high value in 1993. We do the same thing from the bottom. In rank order, we start subtracting until we hit 590. And when we hit Lower Kuskokwim, which has 565 units by itself, of course, we can't eliminate all of theirs. So they set the bottom in 1993. We compare the top and the bottom, and then we calculate the difference and set that in a percentage. And again, in 1993, this number cannot exceed 25%. This particular year is coming out 19.81. Now, we've calculated a preliminary number for 1994, and our preliminary number that's draft at this point is 20.15. Our preliminary number for FY95, based upon budgets, because the year isn't ended yet, is 20.66. So we, once again, are seeing a general trend towards rising in disparity because of the push for more local dollar due to the instruction unit value being held at 61,000. With no increase in state aid and with loss in buying power, there's more and more pressure on the local government to contribute more to schools. As those local dollars come in, it increases disparity. And at the same time, interest earnings and other earnings in the REAs are being held down at lower levels as compared to prior years. So again, our disparity is generally on the incline. Now, we must submit to the federal government by March 1 our 1994 preliminary data to be used for our new disparity. The federal government is just now trying to draft regulations on how we implement the new law. So they're building regulations at the same time that we're trying to decide how we submit our data. So there may be some questions you have that I can't give you a complete answer yet at this point because the federal regulations are not even out for public comment. But that's generally an overview and a briefing on what disparity is. We did send out a memo to all school districts in November indicating that possibly we would be going forward with regulations that would restrict local contributions in order to stay in compliance with the federal disparity standard. Alaska Statute 1417.025 provides for the department to promulgate such regulations if necessary to stay in compliance with disparity standard. At the present time, we're not recommending to the board that we go forward with those regulations. Rather, the administration is going to take the approach to rewrite a formula and have it in place by fiscal year 1998 that would in fact be in compliance with the 20% disparity standard. Therefore, we would not have to restrict districts' ability to contribute now at the 23% limit, which is set forth in statute. So we had put districts on notice in November in the event that those regulations did go out for public comment. At the present time, we're not recommending that to the state board. It doesn't mean that we may not have to go out with an emergency reg at a later date after we've had a discussion with the board, but their first meeting is scheduled for February 27 and 28.
Thank you very much. I'd like to recognize that Representative Bryce joined us at 3:08, and for the record, Representative Robinson was with us at 3:18. And I just so we have in the record for the general public's information, the highest cost per adjusted unit school district in the state of Alaska is North Slope at $133,056, and the least expensive was the Denali district at $61,581, which is obviously why we have a disparity formula involved, because in other states and in the United States, this disparity was used, I think, to punish some folks who lived in various parts of the state. A question, if I might lead off with a question, is one of the topics that we discuss frequently in this committee are single-site schools and how do single sites impact the disparity problem.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, if you refer to page 2 again of the disparity calculation, you'll note that the second wealthiest unit in the state is St. Mary's, as an example, with $91,833. That's partially the result of St. Mary's receiving a single-site supplement, which is outside of the foundation formula. But under the federal definition, they have a very simple definition of which revenue we must include, and it's any state aid, no repayment of which is required, that's available for current operations, must be included. So because the single-site supplement is coming outside of the foundation law and does not carry instructional units with it, it again raises the relative value of each unit in the single-site districts. So you'll see a number of the single sites in a relative basis for a unit value up towards the top of the list. St. Mary's, Hoonah, Galena, Yakutat, Kluwak, Kate, Wrangell, Petersburg. Again, they tend to be higher because we must include those other state revenues in the calculation. Interestingly, when we ran the 1993 disparity, assuming that those single-site supplements were not there, it actually lowered our disparity about 0.25%, 1/4 of 1%. When we ran our 1994 preliminary data, and we ran it again without the single-site supplement, it made absolutely no change in the actual disparity. It made a difference in the relative placement of the units on the list, but the actual disparity was unchanged. And have we run 95 yet? We have not yet run 95 with single-site out. We've just run it based on people's budgets, which includes the single-site supplement. But we're not sure if it would have an effect on 95 or not.
I'd like to acknowledge that we are on teleconference, listen only, and Larry Wiggett is online in Anchorage following our discussion. Questions for Mr. Guiley?
Just one quick question.
Representative Tui.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the 93. What are you doing with the money for ADAC? Is it just not counting that in there? There's no funding for ADAC. Is that correct?
ADAC School District is in a unique situation in that they have projected approximately 150 students this year. And under our current state law, they're allowed to receive 75% of the state aid that they actually received last year based on the number of students enrolled. When they saw they were going to be opening this school year with zero students, the superintendent wrote a letter to the commissioner asking the commissioner to withhold all state aid. So they are existing entirely on federal impact aid at the present time. Now, whether or not we include the amount of state aid which they're eligible for, when we actually do our disparity calculation, it'll depend upon, I guess, the final outcome of the year. But at the present time, we are not paying them any state aid. They are relied entirely on their federal funds.
Again, to put names and faces together and make it a little more real, because I admire your ability to have a command of all this process, because, as you remember, we've tried to rewrite the formula from in a previous administration, and I think when they got to the part where they said expect a miracle, they just gave up. In any case, could you, for the committee members, tell us how, if changes aren't made, this impact funding would affect the funding for the schools in their district, up or down? We have Anchorage, Kenai, Juneau, Fairbanks.
Well, basically, one of a number of different scenarios will play out if we do not have a new formula in place for fiscal year 1998. Certainly, one option is to go back to U.S. Congress and receive and request some relief from U.S. Congress of the new 20% disparity standard, and hope to extend the 25% and continue to move forward working on a formula that we might have in place in 1999, if not in 1998. Under our current state law, if we do not have a new formula in place and we're obligated to continue our existing formula, then we would ask the legislature for an increment in general fund revenue to support the foundation program. Based upon our 1995 year, that amount would have been approximately $43 million. Based on our 96 projection, that amounts about $35 million. So using the budget amount for 96 as an example, if that were the number in 98, we would be asking you for a general fund increment of $35 million to take place of the impact aid deduct in our formula. If the legislature did not grant that amount, then under the current state law, we would prorate the instruction unit value. And that would result in a proration of the unit value of just less than $3,000. I think it's around $2,850.
So you're telling me that the ADM would go drop from $61,000 to $3,000?
Right. It would drop down to about $58,000. $58,250 would be the estimated prorated unit value in 1998 if we don't have a new formula in place, or if we don't get relief from U.S. Congress, and if the legislature decides not to fund the increment. Now, of course, a number of the unknowns are what will the value of impact aid be in 1998. The entitlement value under the current law, the reauthorized law for our state, is about $44 million. We're already budgeting $35 million for 96 because Congress has chosen to short fund the program. And we recognize the impact aid 1 year after it's received by our districts, so we know in advance how much money's out there. Now, what it might be in 97, there's already estimates that in the new Clinton budget, impact aid is reduced another 26%. Our deduct rate on impact aid is about 60% of total receipt. So with a 26% reduction at the federal level, 60% of that would be a general fund increment again. At the same time, we're asking for an increment of growth in student population, which averages 2 to 2.5% a year. So the unknowns, what will the value of the impact aid deduct be, whether or not we can get any relief from Congress, and whether or not we can get a formula through the legislature next year. If we do not get it through next year, there's some doubt as to whether or not we could actually submit by March 1 of 97 this substantially revised formula that would meet the approval of the U.S. Secretary based on the preliminary data to allow us to move forward to current year data and not use the two-year-old data. right now it appears that we will be over the 20% disparity standard in 1996 if something doesn't happen. Because again, we're at 19.81, we calculated 20.15 for 94, preliminary of 20.66 in 95. We are going up. Now that certainly doesn't say that the legislature couldn't step in the middle of the year in 1996 and say we need to do something now to control disparity. We need to do something through the foundation law. If we do it through the law, it will be subject to less challenge in the federal court and in the federal arena on, as far as impact aid appeals. If it's done outside the law through a supplemental, such as a single site supplemental, we're currently defending those at the federal level at the present time. And depending upon the outcome of that, we may or may not be able to deduct impact aid.
So we're given three options. We can expect a miracle from Congress, and with the with them rushing to provide Alaska with special consideration, I'd say that was fairly low. We can expect the state to come up with an increment of $40 million in face of declining budgets as demand for budget cuts, or we can change the formula. I think we have a job cut out for us, because we only have one option, it would appear to me. Questions from Mr. Guiley? Do you already know more than you want to know about impact aid? Do you have any other questions as to why we will be addressing the formula? With our thanks for the briefing, and again, wishing you the best. That brings us to House Bill 28, Possession of Guns and School Property. If I might, I will pass the gavel to my able co-chair.
All righty.
And with your permission, Madam Chairman, I'll remain here so that our committee doesn't look any smaller than...
For the record, House Bill 28, Possession of Guns on School Property, and we have... two people signed up to testify, and do we have anybody on? Is it listen only? It is listen only.
We're
finished with teleconference. Fine, thank you. Alrighty.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, present a sponsor statement. This, again,
please,
is a bill that some of you have seen before, addressing a problem that unfortunately hasn't gone away in the interim. Pardon me. My cough hasn't gone away either. However, there is an added complication or incentive, perhaps, to address this bill this year. We addressed it on our own volition last year. This year, we are required to address this issue or stand to lose federal funding. And after our previous briefing, obviously, we don't need any more challenges as far as school funding. This act, the Federal Gun-Free Schools Act, was passed by Congress, and it requires that certain conditions be met before we receive federal education funds. And the purpose of this bill is to put us in compliance, one, with the federal mandates, and two, to address a growing problem in Alaska, and that is students who bring guns to school. In a nutshell, the possession of a deadly weapon on school grounds, in the parking lots adjacent to schools, or while participating in a school event will be prohibited. However, a person can obtain permission from a chief administrative officer of a school to carry a prohibited weapon on a school to make allowances for school rifle teams and that sort of thing. I will interject that this does not apply to sworn law enforcement officers, of course. This requires a one-year expulsion or suspension of a student that possesses a weapon on school grounds, and that is to bring us in compliance with the federal regulations. In addition, it requires an annual report to the Department of Education regarding the number of students expelled and the types of weapons involved. again, an interjection in that in researching this bill, we found that not all schools are not always interested in providing accurate information about the guns that end up on schools. It makes them look bad. And to me, it's an attempt to sweep the problem under the rug, I think, in some cases. The legislation also allows school lockers to be searched to determine compliance with school regulations and state laws. The policy on locker searches must be posted prominently throughout the throughout the school. These are truly random searches. They are allowed to victimize a certain group of students or a particular student. The notion here is that the lockers are indeed public property. The students temporarily using them. In practical reality, at least in the Anchorage area, students share lockers, and so it's really not a personal possession. Again, doing research on this bill, I found that in schools in the lower 48, the lockers were the center of activity, of criminal activity. It's where many dangerous and deadly weapons were kept. It's where contraband was kept. And it's, of course, where students who had legitimate students, law-abiding students, where they were having their personal possessions ripped off. Some school districts have gone to the point of removing all lockers. And school violence, theft, went down considerably because they just didn't have the location. Other schools you've probably heard about have gone to the point where they even have to have see-through backpacks. Fortunately, I don't feel Alaska's to that level, but we do have problems that need addressing regarding guns on schools, and I think both thrusts of this bill will go a long ways towards solving Alaska's problem. And Madam Chairman, if I might, then I'm available for questions, or perhaps we need to hear the rest of the testimony.
All right. Other questions of the committee? Yes, Representative Price.
Just to, so I'm clear in my mind, this is exactly the same bill then that we put out of our committee last year?
Madam Chairman, no, not exactly, because we have to address the requirements of the federal law.
Okay.
Before we take any further questions, I do believe I'll entertain a motion to adopt this, the CS 51/F. Thank you. Hello.
My name. I'm Gary Davis.
Representative
Chairman,
Davis.
I'll,
yes.
I move we adopt CS for House Bill 28.
There we go. Uh-oh.
Thank you.
Get the glasses.
Hearing none, we have adopted the work draft F for the rest of this hearing. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee? Hearing none, why don't we go to public testimony. Helen Merkins, if you please come forward and state your name. For the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Helen Merkins, and I'm with the Department of Education. I am the Health Education and Health Program Coordinator. Among my duties is to coordinate the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Act, which is a federal act that comes to the Department of Education and to the schools in the state. Related to that was the Gun-Free Schools Act that Representative Bundy just mentioned, and I have been working with school districts for the last few months to become in compliance with this particular act. Representative Bundy has already identified the major portions of this bill that one is that the state, if it is going to continue to receive $90 million in Elementary and Secondary Education Act funds, which are the primary grant funds to school districts in the state, must become into compliance with the federal law that requires school districts to expel from school students who have brought this weapon to school under the federal definition of a weapon. And then there is an opportunity for schools on a case-by-case basis to waive that after the case has been looked into during that hearing process. We also we wanted to state that as a department, we are in favor of those components of this bill and are hoping that those will be passed. Not only are we in favor because of the threat to federal funding, those kinds of requirements, but in fact, many districts are already in compliance with the part about schools expelling students who bring weapons to school. And we find that everyone from the state board on down to every school district is in favor of whatever it takes to keep schools as a safe place for students. And so with that in mind, we would like to support those components of this bill. I'm also prepared to answer as many questions as possible. This is fairly new guidance, as you know, but we've been in constant contact with your staff as well as the staff at the U.S. Department of Education for the most recent interpretations, and they have a list of our questions that they haven't gotten to yet. So I'll be glad to help when
good.
I can.
Thank you, Ellen. Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If I remember right, last year when we discussed this, there was a question in the villages as to what was school property, because there's no metes and bounds and surveys in a lot of villages. And a lot of children will run their snowmobiles and four-wheelers and motorcycles or whatever else down the streets, and sometimes they have rifles on if they're going hunting or something, and they don't know where the school property is. So have you discussed that at all, or what, in your meetings with different school districts and personnel?
Not at this point, no. Okay. We've had that question from two districts. And not the rest.
Representative Bundy?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, I certainly recall a discussion we had. And this requires, my original bill required a gun to be unloaded in a case. Now it says the federal law says it will not have a gun on the school property. And I think we amended the bill previously to make exceptions for rural schools. But I guess it's my reflection that I think people pretty well know what school property is, like there's no free lunch. If you want federal aid, if you don't know where school property is, you must find out and keep guns off school property.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Yes, Representative Robinson.
Yeah, Helen, how is this going to affect the general school district where we have a shooting range within our bottom of our school?
That's one of our biggest questions across the state. We've, in fact, built a number of those.
Madam Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
It does allow for the school administrator to grant permission so that gun ranges could continue.
Through the federal policy? Okay.
The federal requirements are concerned about students bringing guns to school, not adults particularly, although that clearly is a concern for all of us as well. The other option activity is that actually the definition of weapon has an exclusion in it for sporting, recreational, and cultural purposes. Under those are reasons why a school administrative officer can allow students to bring guns to school for that particular reason. And that's understood to mean things like rifle gun safety classes, the junior ROTC programs that some schools have, for those explicit purposes only.
Thank you. Representative Bryce?
I remember that last session that when we were discussing this, that there was great concern about rural schools where you're showing up on your three-wheeler or your snow machine and wolves are in the area, or possibly bear, or for that matter moose, whatever, and you do carry a weapon to protect yourself as a possibility. And I remember we had addressed that somehow, some way, but that's not in the bill, huh? We took those sections out, did we? I guess let me put that in the form of a question. Did we take those out? And if so, is there no leniency with the federal program to taking those concerns into consideration?
Representative Bundy, would you like
to answer? Yeah, Madam Chairman, I have attempted to address that in Section 1 A and C allows for rural exceptions. However, I don't know that this is, as earlier testimony indicated, this is a question that we need to be addressed by federal folks yet. And my interpretation and my intent at this point is that the school administrator, as we mentioned, for sporting and for cultural purposes, the school administrator could grant these exceptions. But it would have to be, I think, some formal process. It's not
just
you just drive through and say, hey, it doesn't apply to me because I said it didn't apply to me. So there will be, I think, some procedures involved.
Mm-hmm.
And if I might continue, as it was mentioned earlier, you know, what is exactly the school yard and the school boundaries? I think there's going to have to be an awareness of where that leaves off and the woods begin.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Rice?
Go ahead. Let me ponder for a bit.
Yeah, just kind of two other questions, you know, for me is that, you know, like here in Juneau, they already have a policy in place regarding guns in the schools and those sort of things. And I don't really know if they have one-year expulsion or not because I don't remember what their policy stated. But it sounds like what you were saying, though, that again, it would be automatic expulsion until there was a review. Or is that... Absolute.
There's room. The requirement is that would be the penalty, the 1 year suspension. After that has occurred, then you can go back and look at what there's always a hearing and appeal process that results in that expulsion. I mean, that's the way schools do that. After that expulsion has taken place, the student may go through some sort of program that allows them to basically become rehabilitated so that they could be put back in either an alternative setting or perhaps they're even allowed back to school more quickly. Anchorage has been doing this for a couple of years, as a matter of fact. They have a referral program that goes through behavior management, anger management, a lot of other kinds of things that students have to go through, and when they're judged to have been sufficiently, they believe that they'll be safe back in the regular school district or the school building, they could be allowed back. But it's quite a long program. It's not an easy thing to go through.
Okay, but that is my main concern is that if a student really is trying, I mean, I also have I recognize and have no problem with the fact that guns should not be brought onto the school grounds and there needs to be, you know, serious penalties for that. And I also have a fear of there being no program, and so what we do is just lose these kids forever. And it sounds like, so within this bill, is that possible too then? To the, no?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, the bill does not address the requirement for alternative programs. That's up to the
okay,
district.
But you wouldn't not let it happen.
It doesn't prohibit that.
It talks about in the last section under subsection B, administrative officer of the school may, district may on a case-by-case basis reduce or otherwise modify the expulsion or suspension of the student.
Okay, Madam Chairman, if I might speak to that point, that not all districts in the state have followed the expulsion policy. That's one of the reasons, and throughout the lower 48, and that's one of the reasons that the federal law mandates the one-year expulsion, because there have been cases where a student in one district is expelled and moves down the road to the neighboring district and passing the problem on, if you will.
Gotcha.
for, okay.
Thank you. Are there further questions of Helen? Hearing none, thank you. Thank you. If you'll stay by. Margo, Knuth is next to sign up. Margo, would you like to come forward, please? Just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Margo Knuth. I'm with the Department of Law Criminal Division, and it's a pleasure to appear before the committee this year. Sorry I haven't made it here sooner. The governor will be introducing a bill also on youth and firearms, and this is an issue of concern to him. This bill is consistent with the governor's approach to the problem, and that bill will be coming out later this week. I would like to note that the federal act specifically requires that case-by-case analysis of students' expulsion. So the federal government definitely envisions there being circumstances when a full year's expulsion is not appropriate, and so it's built into the provision of this bill. In the past, there have been questions about the constitutionality of the locker search provisions, and I thought I would just make myself available to answer any such questions if they are here with this committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Roper.
On that line, would you mind explaining what the problems are revolving around the notice provisions, and also if you wouldn't mind making some comments about the problems with the possession of a firearm or a dangerous weapon on a person's physical being, their clothes, and the book bag issue, or where we are in that whole thing? So.
Through the chair, yes. the Constitution of the United States has a provision that basically protects persons from unreasonable searches and seizures. And the question, of course, is going to be what's reasonable and what's unreasonable. And in this case, school lockers are the property of the school. They are made available to students. And although there's some uncertainty whether Alaska would follow the federal interpretation, it's probably likely that it would. And the way that provision has been interpreted federally is that if a school provides notice that the locker is subject to being searched for weapons or contraband, that the searches can be conducted, and that the students do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in either firearms or contraband in their lockers. The school is prohibited from using any other items that might be found in the school locker as a basis for any action against the student, and sometimes the fear has been, suppose you find birth control measures in the locker, can you expel a student for that if there was a school that disapproved? No, you could not. That's neither, you know, it's not a contraband item. With respect to searching a student person, pat-down search, or wanting to search a day pack that the student has, there isn't anything similar to the consent that you can impute to students who are using a school locker. This is my locker. If you use it, I have a right to search it. The Constitution applies fully to students for being safe from unreasonable search and seizures of their persons or possessions. So it is possible for a student to bring a gun in a day bag, and the school does not have authority, any more authority than a police officer would, to for no reason at all ask to search the student or the day pack that the student has. At the same time, if there's any reason to believe that the student does have a firearm, then you have a basis for a reasonable search and seizure. And what the government is precluded from doing is acting randomly, acting like Big Brother, and, you know, the sense of I can intrude anytime, any place. But when you have information that suggests the possession of a weapon which is illegal under state law, then you have a basis for the search to be made.
Chairman, does this mean to say that the administrators of our schools have to take classes in legal evidence and in search and seizure constitutional law provisions to define probable cause to pat down a student? Or, I mean, where are we on that?
Through the chair. In fact, there are schools down south that have metal detectors at their entries because that is a known constitutional way of finding guns. And it is, as you say, a difficulty to to become an expert in the law on what's a permissible search and what is not. It would take some efforts to provide that information. At the same time, when you have a genuine problem, a person must rise to it and do what can be done. And I think that in Alaska, we've reached a point, particularly in Anchorage, where everybody's motivated to try to deal with this problem.
Madam Chairman, is that on the same line there? Then would the, like a probable cause standard that a law enforcement officer have, would the school administrator have to abide by the same standards?
Again, through the chair, yes.
Incredible, incredible.
Did you have...
And then follow on to Madam Chairman. Do we have any provisions in the state statute to allow a search for contraband items? You mentioned that in your testimony.
Madam Chairman, we do not have it in our statute. It's a part of the common law in Alaska. What this bill is doing is codifying what we believe is existing law. And it's comforting to have it in print in the statute. Everybody will, I think, feel more secure on what the limits are on the searches. I think the provision of notice is a good one.
Madam Chair, is there a need for a statutory provision for contraband to be included in something like that? Or
it's not necessary.
Thank you. Are you finished? Any other questions? Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could might interject just as long as we're on that topic, as someone who has some personal experience in what goes on in the schools, I can assure you not just the administrators, but each teacher is very, very aware of their legal limitations when it comes to disciplining a child or even physically touching the child.
Thank you. Representative Bryce, do you have a comment?
Yes. An earlier question had been raised about what the school administrator can and can't do as far as allowing for a special circumstances. I was wondering, I couldn't find that specifically in the bill, and I was wondering if there was a section that we could specifically point to that. Maybe I let's see.
What was it?
I guess.
I'm sorry. Who's on first? What's on second?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, if I might offer, I don't have the work draft. I have House Bill 28, and it was on page 4, lines 23 to 25. The administrative officer of a school district may, on a case-by-case basis, reduce or otherwise modify the expulsion or suspension of a student under A of this section.
Well, see, that's not the point. The student still has to be expelled or suspended for participating in a school activity.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, I'm not...
I mean, on a case-by-case basis, reduce or otherwise modify the expulsion or suspension. We're talking about the student still has to be expelled or suspended, not that if the student's got or had some type of legitimate purpose to have the firearm on campus or somebody else having the firearm on campus, that such as, you know, the three-wheeler kind of a deal in rural Alaska. I don't see where that covers it. I think you still have to suspend or expel the student. And while you might, then it's the burden's on the student's back.
Madam Chair,
now maybe is there another place?
Yeah, on page 3.
Okay.
Beginning on line 3. Except a student may possess, other than a firearm.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman, the federal definition of firearm is very unusual, and it excludes rifles that, for purposes of competition, firearm does not mean any gun. It means the type of gun that the federal government believes do not belong on school grounds. And I don't have it before me, but I think it's in that manner that they've addressed the problem you're talking about, that if you have a gun that you're using for the shooting range, and I actually don't know whether they envisioned a gun for personal safety from wolves or bears, and that may be something that the feds would want to address for Alaska. But they dealt with the problem in terms of their peculiar definition of firearm.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess as well as it can be answered, the answer being that we don't know.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Roper.
What happens if students share lockers? And also, is there some kind of a hearing or due process procedure for a student that's accused of possession?
If I might,
for sharing the locker?
There is a hearing process for an allegation that the student is possessing a weapon that should be expelled, and there's due process provisions. With respect to sharing a locker, I don't have information about that. Generally, in other search and seizure areas, if you have two people with control over an area and one of them has consented, that's binding on the other person. In this case, all of the students will be consenting to the search of the locker because they are using it on that understanding and on that condition.
But their hearing, excuse me, Madam Chairman, the hearing process is in place if one student says that this is not my gun and the other one says it's not my gun, and so there's a form in which they can defend themselves.
I imagine that's a case by case.
Well, I mean, there is a procedure they can defend themselves. Madam Chair.
It isn't addressed in the bill, but each school has disciplinary policy which involves rights of the students, and the students, they have a student bill of rights, if you will.
And, two kind of technical things, Madam Chairman. One, I've noticed that there's a provision here for referral to law enforcement authorities.
Page and the line, please.
Oh, I'm just saying there's a provision here for that, but my concern is on page 1, line 10, it says misconduct involving a fourth degree. Then it goes on further here, there's a fifth degree. Are these misdemeanors, or what is this? I'm not understanding what that is.
Let me refer to the Department of Law, but it is misdemeanor.
Is that what that's referring to? Is that okay? And then additionally, there's kind of a technical point here and a legal question. On page 2, line 22, the word premises is used in traversing a school premises. Madam Chair and our witness, in my business, the definition of premises usually is an improved property or building, vis-a-vis a real property of land, an estate and land. I mean, so to me, the word, this is like if you traverse a school building. So in other words, I wanted the definition of premises here. Is that the right word?
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
Premises, for purposes of this statute, would mean property, whether it's been improved or not, and it's the boundaries of that which is owned or belongs to the school or is associated with the school, and it's not limited to the building portion of the property.
Madam Chairman, are we defining it in this act for that, or is that just common law, or what are we using to define it?
There is a common law definition, and I could look at Title 11 and see if we have a statutory definition as well, but it would be very unusual for the statutory definition to differ from the common law definition.
Madam Chair, just my use of the term of art in real property law is different, that's all. So I'm just curious about it. So.
Thank you. Representative Roper, other further questions? Hearing none, thank you, Margo. Are there further questions? Anybody else in the audience would like to testify? Hearing none, we'll close this to public testimony. What is the wish of the committee?
Madam Chairman, if I may, I'd move that we move House Bill, or committee substitute for House Bill 28 to the next committee of referral, accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Hearing none, so moved. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Byers. Go ahead, because I've already heard this. I've done it once. You can take it.
All right. You need to translate it?
Okay, we're back to order here, and
This brings us to House Bill 94, Private Management of Public Schools. And we have Representative James with us. Representative James, if you would present your bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My bill is a simple little bill that just authorizes school districts to contract with private agencies to manage the schools. And it came to my attention, I've talked to lots and lots of teachers, and one of the biggest distress that I find with teachers, and they're very good teachers they are, is that they are not allowed to teach as they ought to teach in classrooms for various reasons. And the time that they spend during the day, small percentage of their time maybe is even in teaching, and much of it is in report writing and other administrative duties. I also hear from teachers that they would like to have a RIF program, because there are some that are ready to retire and they're just burned out for all those various different reasons. And I feel that there is a pool of intelligence there that might be spirited into doing something else if we were to allow private contracting of the management of our schools. Now, I'm not exactly sure and feel quite likely that this is already an ability to do, that we could do this without this law. I think that probably it's not prohibited anywhere in the statutes, but I might have to ask someone else about that. But I thought that putting this piece of legislation in, which allows them to do that, that might spirit some ideas by somebody somewhere that they might want to do that. One of the biggest things that you hear in the public about our school system is people want to make it more efficient. People want to make it more effective. People want to have better academic achievement by the students, and they want better behaviors by the students, and all of the different kinds of things that are out there that cause people to be distressed with the school system. Additionally, people are interested in trying to get better education for less money, and it appears to me that in our efforts to try to determine how we can do government and education and all those other things that go with government better is that the opportunity to contract with private individuals to perform services is an option that we ought to consider. All of the protections that we have in the education system still remain. The school board would be the persons that would be determining what or what could not happen in the schools. And that would be all in the contract process. It might be anticipated. I know there are some management companies out in the lower 48, that other country, where things happen and some have had maybe good experience and bad experience, and I don't think, like a lot of people, I don't think that we in Alaska have to invite them in to solve our problems. I think we have people here in our own state that can solve the problem. This won't change anything, and it won't happen if school districts don't want to do it. And school districts, I wouldn't believe, would want to do it unless someone presented sufficient plan and so forth to be able to do it, and I think that by having it as private agency as opposed to a nonprofit group, that private agency indicates that people want to make some money doing it, and they know that they have to work within our confines of our existing budget process. So I believe that this is a good step, and that this might open up some new ideas for education in our state. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Tui.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions. Having heard this 2 weeks ago, there were some questions that were posed to me later on concerning the fact that this was, that the fear was out there that this would become a vehicle for religious schools, there's a fine line there between what people perceive as being a religious school or a private school teaching religious or whatever. How can you prevent that?
Well, if I might, Representative Tui, all of the laws that we have on the books now that prevent public schools from being religious would still apply. We're not drawing any line, taking any of the existing rules and regulations regarding public schools out. The only thing that we're doing here is allowing the school district, as opposed to hiring the administration and hiring the teachers and hiring those things by an administrative procedure, that what we're doing is they're saying, okay, here's some people that come forward and have made an offer to be able to contract to do all that. for a set number of amount of money, and that contract would have to apply and support all of the existing rules and regulations that we have regarding our education system. It would not change that at all.
And the other question that was posed to me, would you be able to keep teachers that were not members of a union? I mean, could you run the school without unionized teachers?
Yes. That would be the only change that we would have from our existing school systems, is that the private agencies would not be required to have union teachers.
But they could have if they...
They could have. They could be part of the program. They could have or could not have. That would be up to the agreement that would be made. That would be purely, simply a part of the contract. Thank
Representative Price.
If teachers, if they can hire teachers who are not part of NEA, what collective bargaining unit would teachers be under then, considering that they do fall under, since they're still public teachers, and they fall under Title 14 in collective bargaining?
If I might, and the drafter of this bill is here too, and I might want to ask him legal questions that I'm not familiar with. Mr. Ford, if you might want to come up here, get ready for this onslaught of questions that I can't answer.
Legally,
point of order here. We don't have onslaughts in this committee.
But my response to that would be is that it would be a public school managed by a private industry,
mm-hmm.
And that I believe that the private industry would be insulated from the requirement of the teachers' union. I would believe that. Now I can ask Mr. Ford if he...
Representative Bryce.
Okay, so it would be, say, the people within the administrative organization, the school management, privatized school management organization, that would not necessarily be union, but the teachers themselves still in the classroom, considering that they are they're still public employees, that they would still maintain their collective bargaining status?
My response to that is they would not be public employees. They would be employees of this private organization.
Okay.
Which has a contract to maintain a public school, the rules and regulations of public education.
Okay. So it's not just an administrative group we're talking about. We're talking about a private organization to run everything from the school, below the school board.
That could be, or it could be any portions of it.
Oh, so it could be a situation where they just deal with the...
I would think that, but okay. By putting this bill out there, that just makes uh-huh. it available for school boards to contract with private uh-huh. enterprise, would be the ones, the school boards would uh-huh. be the creative ones in this issue to figure out what would work. Uh-huh. Am I doing okay, sir?
Madam Chair, Representative James, you're doing great. I haven't heard anything I would disagree with. Okay. I think there's flexibility attached to the provision at this time. They could conceivably contract for the purchase of toilet paper.
Uh-huh.
Or they could contract for, everything from the school board down. There's no requirement in law that union teachers be hired. You could hire non-union teachers as long as they meet the other requirements of law.
You just said something that made me very antsy, because I was being very careful not to go to that step. You said school board on down. I said below school board. You're saying that we... Okay.
It doesn't replace the school board.
It does not replace the school board. Not intended to ever replace the school board. Only the management and the administration of the education system.
And the education...
Can I interject it for a minute so our secretary gets the opportunity, for the record, if you would?
Mike Ford, Division of Legal Services.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And could I...
Representative Bundy's in charge of this section.
Yeah, you're looking at me. So,
along these lines, a question: you say they would not be then public employees, so then they wouldn't qualify for the public benefits, the retirement, health, that sort of thing.
That's correct. I would think not. I expect that a private organization, you know, I suppose those things could be reached for, but I wouldn't think that that would be the goal.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman. Representative James, are you suggesting here that this could be conceivably something that could be characterized as giving a school board, however it was constituted by the electorate in that area, as a a union busting tool where you could throw out the unions of a particular district? Is that feasible?
I wouldn't think that would be the goal.
No, I mean,
I would
it,
think that it is
it
a possibility.
It is
a possibility. I wouldn't think that would be the goal. I would think that the goal would be for better schools, for better everything. And the people that I would visualize that would be able to do this is those teachers who are already on retirement.
Mm-hmm. Already on retirement, I mean, just form an organization, the manager?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman? Oh.
And then Representative Robinson.
Are you aware, are there any, for example, like special education requirements, other certain areas within school districts that there's requirements for providing services? It seems to me that this may be beneficial for a school district to contract out to a private supplier for some special type services.
Special
they may,
ed as an example.
Right, yeah. Would that?
I would think that would qualify under this. I don't think that it is a total thing. It's pieces or the total.
That would be your intent to
that
be able to
give
the
That would be my intent, to make any kind of contracting with a private agency that would achieve the goals that the school district would be reaching for, which would be better education, more efficiency at within the confines of the amounts of available funds.
And just one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Is there anything in the state law that, or does state law allow a majority of a school board to make a decision about this versus going to the voters about it? Is there anything that would prohibit the school board by majority vote from casting out their existing regime and putting in a new private management group under your law?
I don't see anything under the law that would do that. However, I can't visualize it being happening in like that, or I can't imagine the school board doing the organizing. I would think that the school board would be the people would bring it to the school board. The school board wouldn't be looking for it. I would think that would, if it was available, that the people that would like to put this organization together would do so and make their offer to the school board as opposed to the school board looking for a union busting arrangement.
But to follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, your understanding is, I mean, legally, a majority of a school board in the state could make whatever decision they wanted to under this.
They do now,
correct?
I think.
Is that right? I mean, okay. Right.
Representative Robinson.
Right, and Representative James, and some of the questions were similar to Roquefort, but I guess one is, you know, we've received obviously a tremendous amount of public opinion messages against this, and what's your basic feeling regarding that is, you know, why?
I mean, I have all those same opinions, and I've been responding to all of them. And I, you know, the opinions come in a little slanted from what it is that I have. That I'm not here proposing that we have private industry come in and take over the schools. I'm only proposing that should be an option for the school board if, in fact, they could meet the challenges that they have in a better way. And I'm not saying that as soon as this is passed that will happen. But particularly in some of the smaller schools, I think it certainly is an option. And one of the problems that we have with the teachers having to do so much administrative work, I think we could make a flatter organization out of the school district where the teachers at the bottom have more authority about the teaching in their classrooms, which is one of the things that we've gotten away from over the year. I think there are lots of different ways that will never happen in the existing system that we have, never happen in this existing system. And this is just another opportunity to maybe reach to see if we can't make education be less expensive, more effective, and achieve better academic standards from our kids, and behavior as well. They have to follow all the letters of the law that are currently there.
Representative Tui.
Thank you. I think it's interesting. I'm glad you have this back up here. This is a new concept. And, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of new concepts. Obviously, the funding for schools are shrinking and the cost is going up. And maybe this is something this is 20 years from now. They're all going to be private schools or privately run schools for profit. Who knows? And I'm glad you brought this because I think it's something we really should look at.
Well, Representative Tui, if I might respond to that, it's not only in schools and education, but it's everywhere. We have to figure out, you know, our nation is in a real crunch financially. Our state is in a real crunch financially, and we absolutely have to figure out how to meet the needs of our residents and our citizens less expensively and more effectively. We can't have the kids that are getting out of school that can't read and write. And you know, and I know from the old systems, you're not that much younger than I am, that it didn't. We used to have a better system, and we've gotten more complicated now, till less time is spent by teachers teaching than used to be the case. And it's obvious by the way the kids come out of school that that is the case.
I have a question. You don't know if anybody would is waiting in the wings to take advantage of this. This request for the legislation, it didn't come from a school district, but private individuals, is that correct?
It came from me.
Okay, this is your inspiration.
I have to take all credits, my inspiration.
Okay, Representative Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative James, you said we need to meet the needs of our communities. I think we need to offer a means for our communities to meet their own needs,
sure,
more or less.
Sure.
But if I heard right from Representative Roekberg's questions and your answers, this is already allowed? I mean, does it need to be specifically stated and to be allowed, or did I say
I would have to ask Mr. Ford that question, mm-hmm, because it's my understanding that there's nothing that precludes this from happening, which if it's not outlawed, then I assume that it's lawed. But in any event, I'll ask him.
Through the chair. The problem that we have with regional school boards, REAAs, their powers are set out in statute. And if you look on page one here, the language we're adding simply makes clear that they have the power to do this. You always get into discussions when you have a list, well, does this mean that they can only do these things? And in this case, where we say this language is contract with the department, these are all agencies to do this, all, you know, government agencies. It was my opinion that if you want to clearly give them this authority, that you need to add this language to avoid the argument, if nothing else. And for municipal school districts, I think in that situation, there simply isn't any statute that prohibits them from doing this. They could do it now. But again, and to be consistent, I've added some language that clearly sets out that authority.
So, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And two, I see that section one speaks to regional school boards.
REAAs, correct.
REAAs. And what about municipal?
That's section two.
Okay.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, also another thought that has occurred to me is, you know, some of the problems that we're having with our Bush communities in education, where there's a small number of children in the schools and sometimes small number of schools, there's just as much problem of having too few students in a class as there is having too many students, because students learn from each other. And there might be, here again it's all might, there might be some interest in some of the regional districts to go together and create a boarding school of some sort, which could very well be managed on a private basis to be able to take in a whole lot of small schools and offer more educational opportunities to those students. That's just another idea of how that could be utilized if it was an available tool.
Representative Rice.
How would this affect state standards, say, for teaching certificates, that type of stuff? And I guess will the State Board of Education have the ability to establish standards for the groups, for the private agencies, to meet before they can be certified to take over a school district? And in other words, my concern is, us six monkeys here get together and say we're going to make ourselves into a private management agency for schools. What's to keep that from happening? I mean, outside of just...
I believe that my response to that, Representative Bryce, would be that the existing laws apply apply to public schools, and that if this organization wanted to contract, they would have to meet the state law for the requirements of a public school.
I'm,
so their teachers would have to be certified in the same way
their
that they would have to be
the
done.
The teachers might, but what about administrative standards? Is there a section in statute relating to administrative standards as well? I mean, I know the Commissioner of Education needs certain things.
If I might answer your question, Representative Bryce, there are requirements for being a principal. And
Yeah, but we also have a lot of other positions besides principals these days, like information officers and funding gurus like Mr. Guiley and that type of stuff as well. And whether or not there's some way to make sure that those types of people have a certain level of knowledge or background.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen why that would be necessary even. Maybe that's something we should fix too.
Maybe. So I guess in closing, there is no certification process for these people, and we're not even going to look at a certification process in the legislation, or?
I think that's up, personally, may I answer that, Mr. Chairman? I believe that would be having to be established by the school board.
Uh-huh. State school board?
The school board that's doing the contracting.
Okay.
That would be up to them to do that. If there was bonding required or what, all those kinds of things, that would be something that they would have to do. And if a person was coming, if persons or persons were coming forward with this organization, we're doing this all on just kind of a guess what might happen sort of thing.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And I would think that those things would come to light in the process. All I'm doing here is saying it is an option. It's a tool that we might be able to use if the opportunity arose.
Yeah, I would observe there are credentials for administrators, but certainly school secretaries, that sort of thing, I think those criteria are decided by individual districts and buildings even.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about statewide performance standards lately. I would assume that these agencies are going to have to maintain that. I guess statewide performance standards is part of it. But what about consistency amongst administration throughout the state? Not that there's a whole lot of it now, but
I think that whatever the school district, the school board could do.
Uh-huh.
In the hiring and firing of their existing system,
they can do with
they
these
could
folks.
Still do by contracting with a private agency, and the same rules that apply to their hiring and firing of people to do these jobs would still apply in contracting.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would, in response to Representative Bryce, consider, I would think these all of the students are after a state certification. I would think there's plenty of rules and regulations in place that the teachers are certified under and would need to be under additional state law. Administrators probably too, I'm not sure. I know there's administrator certifications, but whether it's required under state law that this private agency would be required, but the curriculum is directed by a large degree by the school boards and so and I think that's probably the beauty of this is, if there is any beauty, is that what's our options for education now? Mm-hmm. And this is providing an option. Mm-hmm. Whether it's good or bad, it gives people the opportunity to find out.
We're asking a lot of speculative questions, and I don't want to cut off debate. But we do have a representative of the Department of Ed here. Who hasn't signed up to testify, but maybe would be available to answer questions.
She's not looking at you.
I'm not telling you, Representative James, it's time to leave. But and we have another person yet to testify as well. But does the Department of Ed have a position on this? And would you like to come forward and give it to us? And Representative James, you will remain with us, will you?
That was really slick, Mr. Chairman. I like that.
You notice how white the poor lady got, too. Or was it red?
She's among friends. For the record,
she's
please.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, my name is Sheila Peterson, and I'm Special Assistant to the Department of Education. Right now, the
who
department
is that?
Right now, the Department of Education is here just to observe and to listen to the dialogue and learn from you and from the interchange as far as what are the possibilities and what are the options.
This, to testify is Carl Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. We support this piece of legislation, but I was not privy to all the discussion that took place here in the last 15 minutes, and that's opened some broad parameters that I'd like to clear some of that up if I could. School boards are political subdivisions of the state. The parameters under which a school board operates are set in statutes, regulations, the funding constraints that are set by the legislature, their local policies and negotiated agreements. These are the pillars of the confines and constraints of a school board. They operate in oversight capacity, and I appreciate this piece of legislation because it gives us some options. And I don't think that the options will be interpreted near as broadly as the sponsor, Representative James, hopes it will be or thinks it might be because we're a political subdivision of the state. As such, we're required to meet the requirements of the state. And as you're well aware, some 4 years ago, we adopted Title 23 Para. We moved labor relations in under Para. At that point, there was a lengthy discussion. In fact, there was a almost two-session debate over the ability of school districts to opt out of Para, the way many of our municipalities were allowed to do back in the 70s. And it was decided that the policy of the state would be that all school districts would fall under the confines of Para and move from Title 14, where labor relations was addressed, into Title 23 Para. So I think when it comes down to the interpretation of what we will be able to do with our employees in the state, I think that's already set. Now, if there were a private group that were to come in and hire new employees, that's not really what I looked at this bill as doing.